Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Bush, trying to jumpstart his second term, held that rare primetime news conference last night. The president seemed to chastise Christian conservatives for conflating faith with filibusters. He expressed concern about high gas prices, but said there was no quick fix. He praised what he said was really good progress in Iraq, but offered no timetable for ending the war. And for the first time, he took the bold political gamble of backing cuts in Social Security benefits for wealthier Americans.
I believe a reform system should protect those who depend on Social Security the most. So I propose a Social Security system in the future where benefits for low-income workers will grow faster than benefits for people who are better off.
What's been the reaction from people outside of Washington? Well, for that, we turn to Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Welcome, Guy.
Hello, Robin.
We also welcome Kevin O'Brien, deputy editorial page editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio. Kevin, welcome.
Hi there.
And Kevin, let's go to your paper first. What's the headline going to be?
Well, this morning's headline was, Bush takes plan to prime time, and president wants to cut Social Security benefits for all but poorest retirees.
And what do you take from that? What's your overarching thought about the speech?
I think he pushed the ball forward a little farther than it had been. We've been on him, certainly on our editorial page, to give some details of his plan for a while now, and this is the first one that's really... the first meaningful one that seems to have emerged, that he's looking at the high end of the scale and he's looking at trimming what those folks get.
You know, and I'm wondering, Kevin, the image in the mind of many of Bush's plan for privatizing Social Security was a very young whippersnappers investing their money. Did he seem to change that image last night and change the focus to the poor?
I think he wants to work on both of those tracks, actually. He didn't really back off from the young whippersnappers and their private accounts, but, you know, in his statement, he was more along the lines of, okay, well, now we also have to talk about something that has to do with the solvency of the system going forward, and that's something that the private accounts have, most people have said, those really aren't going to have that much to do with making the system solvent and keeping it that way in the future.
Right. Guy McMillan up there in Keene, New Hampshire, what's your headline?
Our headline is Bush goes on the offensive. It was a pretty aggressive play, I think, last night. But I don't know that I agree totally with Kevin on him making any kind of breakthrough on Social Security. He still hasn't got a transition plan, how you're going to pay for these private accounts while you're still paying other people's benefits. Now, the one thing that he did say that was new, and I think this is in most of the papers this morning, is that he is prepared to means-test Social Security, he didn't use the term, but it seems to be the idea that the wealthier people would get a little less and the people that relied on Social Security more would get a little more.
Well, one of the most interesting moments in the news conference came during one of the first questions the president took about the role that religion is playing in politics. He said he didn't agree with religious conservatives who've labeled Democrats against people of faith for opposing Bush's judicial nominees. Let's listen.
I am mindful that people in political office should not say to somebody, you're not equally American if you don't happen to agree with my view of religion. As I said, I think faith is a personal issue, and I get great strength from my faith. But I don't condemn somebody in the political process because they may not agree with me on religion.
Kevin O'Brien out there in Cleveland, Ohio, it's a direct contradiction of what much of the conservative religious base has been saying. How's that going to be received?
And I don't think the religious base will care a bit about that because I think Bush has to say what he said, and I think they recognize that.
Guy?
I'm still glad he said it. I think it was a good thing to say, and I'm pleased that he took the time to say it, even though he did have to make up a verb in order to do it.
Moving to energy and the economy, what are people in your neck of the woods saying? You both have aging nuclear plants in your areas. Gas prices, one of the reasons the economy has slowed down a bit over the past 3 months. Kevin, I'm just wondering, in Cleveland, Ohio, one of the president's statements of the last couple of days is resonating. He says, I can't do anything about the high price of gas. How's that resounding there?
Oh, I don't know that people expect him to really do all that much. One thing people in Ohio might have been somewhat more excited about, as long as they're not part of the really environmental crowd, is his mention of clean coal technology last night in answer to a question. Because because Ohio has tons of coal and it's not very clean, so a lot of our power plants are polluters, and it would be nice if the federal government could come along with something that would help us clean that up and use it better.
And one last topic I want to touch on before we let you go, the war. Last night the president said progress is being made. Yesterday a new government was announced in Iraq, but violence has increased. Guy, what are people saying in New Hampshire?
I don't think people are paying attention. This guy is very optimistic about Iraq because he has to be. I think the general feeling here is that we blundered into this thing and now we have to see it through, and therefore I suppose it's nice to find reasons for optimism, although they aren't all that evident.
Yeah, Kevin, overall, was this a successful news conference? He did seem to come out filled with optimism.
I think he's an optimistic person by nature.
But does it work? How will it be received?
Oh, you know, people who like him will say, yeah, he's optimistic and he's confident, and that's good. We're glad to see that. And people who don't like him will say, he's an oaf. You know, he doesn't understand what's going on. I thought he did fine. I think he gets better in those settings every time he does one, and last night was no exception. I thought he did fairly well.
I agree with Kevin on that, and I'm one of these people that doesn't agree with the president on much, but I thought he handled himself well last night. And I was pleased on the religion. I was pleased that he mentioned energy conservation. I think means-testing Social Security is at least rational as opposed to some of his other plans for Social Security. So all in all, I thought it was a pretty good hour.
Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel, Keene, New Hampshire. And Guy, it's a good thing it was, because as you know, the television networks are in the May rating sweeps.
Yes.
Kevin O'Brien, deputy editorial page editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Ohio. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The sounds of a hastily thrown together band welcoming Vladimir Putin to Ramallah in the West Bank today as the Russian president laid a wreath at Yasser Arafat's tomb. It's day three of Putin's visit to the Middle East and the first time a Kremlin leader has set foot on Israeli or Palestinian soil. Putin met with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon yesterday and today with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen. What's the significance? Well, we're joined by Galia Golan, a professor at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya in Israel and an expert on Russian affairs. And, Professor, what's the overall purpose of the Putin visit?
Well, he also was in Egypt with Mubarak before he came to Israel, and I think that rounds out the picture in terms of his purpose. I believe that Putin wants to demonstrate that Russia is still a great power, Russia is still an actor, and wants to be in on the peace process once it looks like the peace process may be getting started again. Russia's there as part of the quartet. But I also think it's connected with domestic issues. Putin is very unpopular at home these days in every single area. And the only area in which he has any support publicly is in foreign policy. So I think he's trying to, in a way, gain some points by showing that he can still act as a world leader and that Russia is still a great power, which is something the Russian people like to hear.
Well, Vladimir Putin is visiting Palestinian leader Abbas today, and Russia has offered to sell, not give, as in the old days, 50 armored personnel carriers to the Palestinian Authority, along with two helicopters. Israel is objecting. Your sense of whether or not this deal can go through?
Well, Israel will not permit the Palestinians to get arms of any kind at this point, although they did have some of these personnel carriers in the past. The rumor here is that Israel may permit the helicopters because they would be for civilian use, for Abu Mazen's personal use. But as far as we know, at this point in time, Israel's not going to permit any kind of arms, even the personnel carriers, or for that matter, light arms for the Palestinian police.
Well, staying on the same topic, Israel also objected to Russia selling missiles to Syria and helping Iran with its nuclear power program. How does Putin defend those two things?
Well, those are two much more serious issues, and they're issues that have been around for some time now. With regard to Iran, the Russian interest is economic, primarily economic, and it's not going to back down under Israeli or even American pressure on the issue of Iran. The Russians have an agreement with Iran that Iran will return the used fuel so that it can't be used for creating weapons. So Putin has actually said here in Israel that Russia and everybody should fear a nuclear bomb in Iran, and that Russia is not helping them get a bomb. The Syrian deal providing surface-to-air missiles to Syria is also worrisome to Israel. It's a traditional concern about Israel when any of its neighbors get arms. But Putin's not going to move on those either. He said that they're not designed against, they're not going to harm Israel. They're just to protect Syria from Israeli flights, overflights. And I don't think anybody is going to move on those issues.
Yeah.
They didn't cause any kind of major rift with Israel. I don't think that Sharon thought he could change Putin's mind about Iran if the Americans can't manage to do it. And I don't think he thought he could change his mind about Syria. In fact, the visit went very well. It was fairly warm, and Israel does have good relations with Russia today.
But getting back to Putin's connections with the region, we know that after the fall of the Soviet Union, thousands of Russian Jews moved to Israel. But I wasn't aware how many Russian women are married to Palestinian men.
Yes, because in the old days of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union would bring people from the Third World to study in the Soviet Union, from Africa, from the Middle East, and certainly the Palestinians. And many of them, while they were there, studied medicine or law, and married local Russian women and brought them back with them. So there are a number of people, and Russian women married to Palestinians, and a lot of children with Russian names, Arab children with Russian names.
And Professor Golan, would you just characterize for us how Russia's relationship with the whole region has changed? I mean, during the Cold War, we understand that the Soviet Union would just do in the region what was the opposite of what the U.S. was doing. What kind of shift do you see happening now?
Well, Gorbachev brought about the difference, the change, and he introduced what could be seen as an even-handed policy, where he would cooperate with the West rather than compete, and together try to satisfy both Israeli and Palestinian interests, which is something that at first the Arab states and the Palestinians were not happy about. They lost the Soviet support that they had, both material and political. And I think that that's basically Putin's policy today. The Russians want to be considered even-handed and therefore good partners. They don't have very much to offer these days. They don't have any influence, actually. And as you mentioned, they're selling arms. They're not giving them away, so that doesn't give them terribly much leverage. America still holds all the cards here, I think.
Galia Golan is a professor of government at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya and a professor emeritus at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Professor Golan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, 8,000-plus Jewish settlers will be leaving the Gaza Strip and moving into Israel proper this summer. But where will they live? We'll ask a real estate agent in Jerusalem, how's business? There's more coming up, here and now. This summer, 8,000 Jewish settlers will move out of Gaza, voluntarily or involuntarily, and move back into Israel proper. It's expected to be a critical event in Israeli politics. But what will the Gaza withdrawal mean for the real estate industry, for housing in Israeli proper? Joining us from Jerusalem is Itzik Levy. He's a partner in Ambassador Real Estate. And Itzik, are you feeling the impact of the 8,000 or so Gaza settlers moving into Israel proper? Are real estate agents such as yourself seeing settlers walking into your offices looking for new homes?
Not so much, really. Most of the people that live now in the Gaza Strip, they're not interested so much in Jerusalem because Jerusalem is too expensive for them. So most of the time, those people, if they have some money, maybe they will buy a second apartment in Jerusalem, small one, but most of the time they will be interested in houses more close to the south of Israel and the center, and Jerusalem will be only the second priority.
Well, so they may not be moving into Jerusalem, but will the fact that this many people are moving into Israel proper at one time have an impact on the real estate market, on those other areas you were mentioning?
I believe that this process will make major impact on the real estate market, because Israel is a very small place and the demand will be high. So I believe that the price of the real estate is going to be very high in the few next years.
But I'm wondering, is there enough spare housing in Israel to accommodate them?
Absolutely not. And what it's pity that the government don't have yet plans where to put those people. One of the plans is to move them in for temporarily to caravan neighborhoods like they made 10 years ago when we had the immigration from Russia.
Caravan neighborhoods, are those, you know, trailers? What?
Yes, like trailers.
Mm-hmm.
For Israel to collect 8,000 people, you need to make plans 3-4 years before. You need to change zoning and then to build those houses.
And this is going to be quite a shock for many of these settlers, because in the Gaza area, they were subsidized by the government. So in many cases, they were living in very nice homes.
They live in very nice homes surrounding large gardens. And it's going to be very difficult for them also to find their new jobs.
Who else is moving to Israel? What's the housing market like in Israel? Who would choose to move there?
Right now we have a very big demand from people, especially from north of America and France. But it's a different process that we had, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago. 3-4 years ago, the people that came to Israel were interested to buy one-bedroom, two-bedroom apartment, you know, as a second home apartment, mm-hmm. for holidays, for Pesach, for Sukkot. Right now, most of the people that are interested to buy a home in Israel are looking for bigger home. And the reason is, I believe, it's because of September 11. From September 11, people understand that terror and bombing could be everywhere in the world. And when they're thinking about second home in Israel, thinking about a place that they could move to Israel one day. And that's the reason why now people more and more buying bigger flats than it was 3 or 4 years ago.
And what are some of the reasons people give for coming? I mean, I can understand wanting to have even just a vacation home in Israel, beautiful beaches. But what are the reasons people are moving to Israel?
So first of all, the reason why people buying now more apartments than 5-6 years ago is because the market now is very low. It's still low.
And it's also probably very low compared to the U.S., which is very difficult, yes, to buy in, yeah.
Right, and the U.S. become very high. Yes. The second reason is emotion. People want to have a house in Israel and especially in Jerusalem. They want to walk to the Great Synagogue. They want to walk to the Old City.
And I'm surprised a little bit at that, not because of the appeal to the religious and the faithful, but because Jerusalem and the future of Jerusalem is such a question mark. So people are still moving there, really not knowing what the future Jerusalem is going to look like when the roadmap is finally finished.
For us, there is no doubt about Jerusalem. Nobody is going to give up Jerusalem. People buying apartments next to the old city because they are sure that nothing can be changed, only for good, mm-hmm. not for bad, only mm-hmm. for good. And the price, you know, next to the old city with view overlooking to the old city are very high.
How much are some of those apartments with the view of the old city?
The last apartment that I sold with a magnificent view overlooking the old city, I'm speaking about one-bedroom apartment, nice size, about 1,100 square feet, with a nice terrace. And that apartment was sold for $975,000.
Boy, Itzhak Levy, a real estate broker and developer in Israel, we're speaking to him from Jerusalem. And Itzhak, we're hearing that there are Israelis right now moving to the Gaza Strip, despite the fact that the settlers are being moved out. Why is that?
There is some people that moving now to Gaza Strip because ideologic reason. But I know about people that bought apartment in the settlement not because ideologic reason, because economic, because they know that in time, when we have agreement with the Palestinians, they will get more money than the value of the houses. Like we had last time when we give up Yemit.
In the Sinai.
Yes, in Sinai.
In the Sinai. So there is precedent for this, by the way, for moving settlers into Israel. But are people in your business assuming that in a few years you're going to see West Bank settlers returning to Israel proper looking for homes?
Yes, and now if we're speaking about the West Bank, we're speaking about much, much more people. And this is a lot of people that the government have to think how to collect them back inside to the country.
Because that will definitely flood your market.
Yes, absolutely.
Itzik Levy, a real estate broker and developer in Israel with Ambassador Real Estate in Jerusalem. Itzik, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. Hope to see you here in Israel soon.
And this note, next week on Here and Now, is the nursing profession in crisis? Journalist Suzanne Gordon thinks so, and she thinks it's endangering your health. That's next week. Stay with us. There's much more ahead here and now. The anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps has been marked in many ways this year. One survivor, Elie Wiesel, was asked by the New England Journal of Medicine to write about his experiences with doctors who worked at the death camps. Wiesel was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. He's a professor of religion and philosophy at Boston University. And 60 years ago, on April 11, 1945, he was liberated from the Buchenwald concentration camp. Producer Rachel Gottbaum spoke with him recently and asked him to describe his first meeting with the most infamous Nazi doctor, Josef Mengele.
He just looked at anyone who passed by and asked, how old were you? And he asked me too, how old were you? But we were forewarned by older inmates who had been in Auschwitz already 2 or 3 years. And they said, and to my father, they said, you are younger, you must say you are younger. And to me, they said, you are older, you must be older. Because at that time, Jews who were too young or too old instantly went to their death. It was as simple as that. Anyone who couldn't work had to die. And the gas chambers were nearby, and the flames of the crematoria were there. We saw them rising to the heavens.
When you say you saw Dr. Mengele, Dr. Wiesel, did you see him again? You talk about in your essay how deadly rumors went around him, you say. Wherever he sprang up, death spread its shadow. Did you understand that he was choosing who would live and who would die?
Oh, yes. The rumors were constant. That Mengele meant selection. Selection means death for those who are too weak, too young, too old, too tired. Mengele meant death. And he conducted the selections until very late.
Could you tell us what the scene was like?
Well, in the room there were doctors. I'm not sure that it was Mengele. The moment the doctor came, a German doctor, it meant that some people were going to die. In those times, medicine did not cure. Medicine was used to kill.
So did that change your response to doctors? Did it totally turn it over on its head of what you used to think of as a doctor and then what happened in the camps in terms of they represented people who killed and not people who healed?
Not me. But I know friends of mine who, after the war, when they were in Germany, in the American zone or even the British zone, if they were sick, they were afraid of being treated by German doctors. They were afraid.
But it did not change your idea?
No, not
Did you not
no.
have an idea of doctors as good coming in before
yes.
you went to the camps?
Of course. But nevertheless, I did not make that leap of skepticism or of rebellion and say every doctor is like that. I didn't feel that. Because there were inmates doctors as well. And I say they were the best. So when I think of the Nazi doctors, of course, I'm filled with repulsion and revulsion. But when I think of those other, the real doctors, who were instruments of humanity and compassion, they bring honor to the medical vocation, and therefore I cannot say all doctors are bad. When I saw, even today, I admire. I'm sorry I chose philosophy rather than medicine, because to save lives, is there anything more noble than that?
Do you have any stories about any of the doctors who were prisoners that you remember?
Oh, absolutely. The end of December and early January, 44, 45, I developed knee pain and leg pain. I was pained, my leg hurt. And I was taken to the hospital. It was swollen all over. And they decided to do surgery without anesthesia. And one of them was very kind to me. And he said, "Don't you know, if you are young, and we will help you," and so forth. And he was a very, I remembered his face. He was there. Somebody performed the surgery, but he was there in the room, in the infirmary, when it happened. And he's the one who made me go through that without shouting and screaming. One day I came to Oslo to give a lecture at the university, and a professor of psychiatry came up to me and said, "And you know, we met before," and he was a doctor.
They did allow prisoners to get some kind of medical care.
Oh, yes. There was an infirmary in Auschwitz, in Auschwitz III, where I was, and there was an infirmary, but of course they had no medication. And they were actually the most unfortunate, almost the most tragic of all, because it's true that they were preserved and they had better food. But for a doctor not to be able to cure, not to have, I think, no medication at all. They used bandages with paper to bandage a wound with paper. But they did it. They were there to help. For them not to be able to offer help except consoling words, I feel empathy with all of them.
Now, you talk about in your essay what is so profoundly difficult to grapple with is the fact that these doctors were highly educated. They were educated people. They were the educated elite in Germany. And how does it happen that the intelligentsia would willingly get involved in this kind of systematic killing?
I have no idea. That is, to me, one of the most disturbing discoveries that I made after the war. That the worst SS were the so-called Sondergruppen. Most of them had college degrees, and many of them had doctoral degrees in medicine, in the arts, and in theology even. I couldn't believe it, because I always believed that education offers a shield, provides a shield against certain things. An educated person does not do certain things. And there they did.
The Nazi doctors were involved in horribly unethical conduct. They breached the Hippocratic Oath. Are there examples of this kind of conduct even today?
Well, in contemporary history, unfortunately, we must say that the Gulag also had its doctors, and the KGB, or before that the NKVD or the GPU, was the secret police, were called in Russia, in communist Russia. It's disturbing, because we would hope that the doctors anywhere and everywhere at any time should always be on the side of the patient and not on the side of the state.
But also, even in more contemporary times, we've heard that Iraqi doctors took off Iraqi soldiers' ears who deserted. They amputated their ears. And what about Abu Ghraib? Do you think about these things as possibly parallel?
Not parallel, because the others really were meant to kill. Here, not only that was the rule. Here, the norm was the perverse doctors. Here is the exception. And even if one is an exception, it's too many. But still, even altogether, they are exceptions. And of course, that was the norm, that doctors collaborated.
Dr. Elie Wiesel is a professor of religion and philosophy at Boston University and a Holocaust survivor. He spoke with producer Rachel Gottbaum about his essay, written for the New England Journal of Medicine. For a link to the article and an extended version of the interview, go to our website, here-now.org. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, this week also commemorates the 30th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and we've heard in the past couple of days the gut-wrenching feelings that provokes. We thought we'd end the week with something else. In Vietnam, they don't like to talk about what they call the American War, and some people are still afraid to talk at all, but as you'll hear, not everyone. Here's an audio postcard, sounds of everyday life from modern Vietnam. Bullets pockmark the citadel, the seat of the old imperial government high above the city of Hue. Below, look closely at that beautiful garden fence outside a modest home. It's made of U.S. barbed wire.
In my house, I still have the can opener made in Milwaukee. So I still use. After the war, we often say American no good, but American stuff is good.
Why do so many Vietnamese women and girls wear long, elegant gloves? A sales girl explains to me it's to protect from the sun.
In Vietnam, you know, that's all the people, they like white skins like you.
Is that why so many women, like when I was in the rice paddies, they would touch my skin?
Yeah, because you have really nice skin. That is true.
But I think you have beautiful skin.
No, for our skin, we don't think we are beautiful because we like white skin. We don't like brown skin or dark skin. That's why everybody, they touch your skin.
At dawn in Hanoi, dozens of mist-shrouded Vietnamese still slowly perform Tai Chi. But now there are as many gathered around boomboxes doing aerobics. Or at night, break dancing.
Hip-hop.
Hip-hop? You are hip-hop?
Will Smith.
Will Smith.
Britney Spears.
Britney Spears?
Yes. Matches Boy.
Beastie Boys?
Yes.
Yeah.
A waitress named Tu asks me to come home to her garden to help her with her homework. Could I please explain Hester Prynne in The Scarlet Letter?
Yeah, she had to wear the Scarlet Letter on her bosom. Yeah. Can you explain it? Yeah. Explain it. America mm-hmm. is a salad bowl.
I try to explain salad bowl and melting pot. And then Tu tells me that her goal in life is to marry a millionaire from New York City.
I have my aunt, yes, live in New York City. She got married with an old man. He is a billionaire. Can you find me another man live there?
In Saigon, a young man gently corrects the way I hold my chopsticks.
In Vietnam, people consider eating as an art.
So the higher I hold it, the more... Is that a
yes,
class?
It's the
a
different... higher you hold it, the more elegant you look. If you home from the middle part, then you come from a very middle class family and it doesn't look very nice.
Right next to the former American embassy in Saigon, you can hear a pin drop at the Museum of War Remnants.
Do a lot of Vietnamese come here?
Yes, a lot of Vietnamese, especially the students who are sent over here for the history learnings, to come over and see the what they call the crimes of the Americans.
Leaving Vietnam, I meet another tourist, American veteran Peter Poulos from Marshfield, Massachusetts. He's also leaving with rich, complicated feelings about Vietnam.
People were so wonderful, so friendly, so helpful. A lovely time. People were wonderful to me. One sobering time when we hired a driver to take us to where I was stationed, Duc Pho, just before getting there, the driver says, "You can't get out. Too many VC." That sent chills up my spine, up and down my spine.
Was he serious?
He was deadly serious by the look on his face. There are a few areas where people still remember, and that was one of them.
Sounds from a modern-day Vietnam. The 30th anniversary of the fall of Saigon is tomorrow. There's more ahead, here and now. we probably all know that a cover is one musical act recording another artist's song. Well, here now is music critic Tim Riley has selected a few of his current favorites. And the train from Kansas City is coming to town. The train from Kansas City is coming, and there's nothing I can do can make it turn around. And Tim joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Well, I recognize the Shangri-La's original version of Train from Kansas City. But then who was that other act?
Well, that's Necco Case. Now, she's raised in the Northwest, and she went to school in Canada, and she's a sometime member of a very, very fine Canadian band called the New Pornographers. But she has a solo career, and she has a new album out, and she pulls out this old chestnut that you go up back and you find on your old Shangri-La's album. It's called Train from Kansas City, and it's one of these great, you know, us rock critics know that there's this great, vast, hidden catalog of songs in the rock and roll a discography, and if you're Necco Case, you can go back and find these chestnuts on these old records. Yesterday I found this letter from the boy I loved before I ever knew you,
before I even knew you. Tell us more about covers. We understand from you that there's a difference between rock covers and other kinds of covers.
Right. Well, a rock cover is more specifically not just a singer singing a song. It's a person recording a different version of a recorded song. All right. So there's that extra layer of interpretation. So, for example, there's a New Order song that appeared on the soundtrack to Trainspotting. The song is called Temptation, and the original version sounded like this. Heaven. And then Moby decides to cover this song on his new album, which is called Hotel, and he does a very different version of the song, and one that fits into this category of a recording, sort of an interpretive recording of the original recording. Heaven, a gateway, a hope, just like a feeling I need, it's no joke. Tim, that is fascinating how one artist could hear almost a completely different song. And what he's doing is he's locating a mood in the original version and isolating it and zeroing in on it, for almost like a microscope, and going in and saying, you know, it's the gloomy aspect of that song that I want to emphasize.
Well, as you know, Tim, my goal is to mention Joni Mitchell in every segment we do.
Yes.
Today, it's in the category of artists covering themselves. Her remake of Both Sides Now on the CD of the same name with an orchestra backing her up. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, and still somehow it's love's illusions that I recall. I really don't know love. I really don't know love at all. Well, yeah, it's part of Joni Mitchell's attempt late in her career to sort of reposition herself, not as a singer-songwriter, which is what she's primarily known for, but as a chanteuse, as someone who's known primarily for their interpretations of songs, for the vocal interpretation she can give her own song. She slows it down and gives it a very world-weary tone, a very different reading. She's a different woman
than she
singing
really
that song.
She's a different woman, right.
Well, I'm really curious about this next cover. Singer Petra Hayden, one of jazz bass legend Charlie Hayden's triplets, not musical notes, by that I mean his children. Petra covered the entire album of The Who's 1967, The Who Sell Out.
Right.
Phenomenal. Now, first of all, remind us about The Who's version.
Well, The Who's Sell Out, you got to remember this came out in 1967, which is Sgt. Pepper's Summer of Love, big psychedelic stuff happening all over pop music. And The Who come out with this record, which is anchored by the single I Can See for Miles and Miles. And what they do is they say, we're going to make a parody record. We're going to make fun of pop radio. So we're going to put in between all our songs, we'll put all these crazy ads and stuff. Radio London, remind you, go to the church of your choice. a very big record for critics, but I Can See for Miles and Miles was not the big hit that it should have been. It only broke top 10. It never got to number one.
I know you deceived me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, 'cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and
The Who's I Can See for Miles. And as you said, the single didn't do well, but how about that album?
Well, the album has survived as one of the great classics. It establishes Pete Townshend as a rock conceptualist. He goes on to do Tommy and Quadrophenia, and The Who get a lot bigger after that. But it still occupies a very, very soft place in a lot of critics' hearts and a lot of rock musicians' hearts. One of those musicians, Mike Watt, who is the bassist for a very important punk band called The Minutemen, decided that Petra Hayden should do a vocal version of this record. And he gives her an 8-track machine with The Who sellout on one track and just tells her, just overdub the vocals on the remaining 7 tracks. So that's what she does. And the marvel of this project is that it actually lives up to its idea. She does a complete vocal a cappella rendition of The Who sellout.
Let's listen. Petra Hayden, I Can See for Miles.
I know you've deceived me, now here's a surprise. I know that you have, 'cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles.
It's just an astonishing record. And every inch of the Who sellout record is very faithfully readapted in a cappella arrangement. So all the ads, all the funny little snippets, all the voices, all the sort of, some weird studio noise, it's all in there.
Our love was dun, dun.
Petra Hayden really is sort of like the superlative example of the cover because it transcends its model. In other words, after a while, you start hearing Hayden's version of The Who sellout, and you don't even think about The Who anymore. It's such a tour de force. You listen to it just for its own sake. It takes it to a new level. It's something that you thought you knew. You hear completely new aspects of it in her version, and then her version sort of lifts off and becomes something new in itself.
Here now is music critic Tim Riley, also author, by the way, of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender. It comes out in paperback next month. We want to make a note of that. But Tim, thanks so much for sharing this cover music with us, and we'll make sure our listeners can get a list online.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you. And for more information on the CDs we talked about, check out our website, here-now.org.
Welcome to my life, tattoo. I'm a man now, thanks to you. I expect I'll regret you, but the skin graft gun won't get you if you'll be there when I die. Tattoo.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Because mine said mother, but my mother naturally liked it and beat my brother. 'Cause his tattoo was of a lady in the news, and my mother thought that was extremely rude. Welcome to my life, tattoo. We've a long time together, me and you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.